Blog Talk Radio. Speaking to you live from New York, and it's a cloudy day after that, this Thanksgiving, you know, all that stuff and eating and resting and whatever. Ugh. I cannot go shopping. What about you, Miss Cynthia?
Please, I'm on an IV juice fast drip now to undo the damage that was done in the past 5 days. It was like a feeding frenzy for me. I started out good. I ended up bad. So.
Well, you know what? It always happens. But I have to tell you, I went out for two meals on Thanksgiving. I was out and I went to see my friends, Pat and Tim, and Pat's mom, who's 89, God bless her, was in town, and I wanted to see her. And what was decadent for me was that because they didn't cook the Thanksgiving dinner, we went to the Soho House, who put on an amazing, amazing buffet. And I was very much happy to be sitting at they had oysters and shrimps, and I was at that part of the buffet, just eating several times there. And then I had to run to my cousin Vandy, and I got there just in time to put when they were putting down the turkey. So I got it just in time. So two meals.
Yeah. Well, I went to Anthony Andrews, our buddy's house, and of course Nancy is a foodie. So it was, I'm lucky I didn't explode in the ride back to my house. But let's just put it to you this way. December 1st will be a rude awakening. I was going to say today is my last day to just pig out, but my house has been stripped bare of food because I ate it all in the past 4 days. So
there you go. Oh, you know who called me also? I just got a call yesterday from our girl, Frida Kelly, who is in L.A. She's in L.A. at the moment because they're out there for the auction that Ringo Starr, for his stuff. And, she's been in America. She's been traveling more than any of us. And, for whatever else. And quickly, we also have that new controversy, of course, on the article that came up. And that's been posted.
She whose name will not be mentioned. This little Andy Peebles, apparently, from what I understand, he had the last real interview with John Lennon and Yoko Ono. And then after... he was on his way home on the plane and received word when he got there that John had been killed. And he developed this friendship with Yoko Ono. And I know you're in a precarious position to make a lot of comments about it because you've been referred to as the mistress, which we all know was not true. You were not a mistress. You were a girlfriend, legit, and they were separated. But, May, it just appears to me that she's like a black widow spider, weaving a little web and waiting to see who's going to tug on the strands of her web, so she can go and bite them. I don't know.
I just feel very bad because I understand where Andy is coming from. I read the article, never met the man, so I have no idea. Just one correction. It wasn't Sam Habitoy at the time. It was our musician that Yoko was in was really attracted to, he was in a position people don't understand. I was reading all of this because everybody was sending it to me, and I thought I give him credit for doing it. It's this many years later, but remember people have a tendency to forget. He couldn't say anything. He was still working at the time, and you can't say certain things, and it's obviously bothered him up until this day. He could have just let it drop, but he couldn't.
Yeah.
And so it's obviously something that's been gnawing at him, and and he's not the only one. I know somebody else, and I've known a couple actually, that it's happened to as well. And as soon as you know, things didn't go, they were no longer in the mainstream, they were dropped as well. So, I mean, this is not unusual. I've seen it. It's, you know, I'm, you know, I wish him luck on this one.
Well, I do too. But, you know, the bottom line is this, and then we'll move on because we have a fantastic guest today.
Yes,
but the bottom line with this is it's really unfortunate that she has not tried to repair her public image by turning over a new leaf. I just don't understand that when you've got that kind of money. And it just occurs to me, and I'm only saying this, I'm an armchair philosopher now. I'm saying what she couldn't control in his life, she now controls damn Skippy in his death. And she's taken no prisoners, and it's really sad. And I hope that this guy gets some kind of satisfaction from it. I mean, you know your truth, and so do, you know, everybody who loves you. So, but well, you know what? We'll talk about this on another date when we see how this evolves. But in the meantime, it kind of does lead into our guest today.
Absolutely.
And you and I have many, many, many times talked about the fact that there was a time period in music that's going to stand alone that is never going to be touched. It was just a special, magical time. And there are people, we can still listen to the music, but there are people who choose to journalize, to make a diary, to make sure that it's written down so that they keep a history of it in books so that people can go back and read about it, because that's all we're going to be able to do is read about it. And with that, I'd like to welcome today. He's an author, he's a producer, and he has written books documenting that particular time in music history. He's got a new one out, Riot on Sunset Strip, Rock and Roll's Last Stand in Hollywood. Welcome, Dominic Priori.
Yes.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
I love the photos that you have in the book. I mean, they're, it just takes you to another, just brought me back. That's all. Just brought me back. I say that.
Well, I originally didn't have a lot of confidence in my writing, you see, so I went out and got the very, very best photographers, guys like Julian Wasser, Lisa Law, Chuck Boyd, Henry Diltz. I spoke to all of those people whose names you've heard over the years and tried to – and another guy that's really overlooked, George Rodriguez, who took all the photographs of Cesar Chavez on his you know, journeys through Central California in the protest movement there.
Right.
Well, you know, he also was the house photographer of Whiskey A Go-Go before that.
Right.
Which is not something a lot of people know. And he had amazing color pictures of, like, the very first Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention gig at a little small club on Santa Monica Boulevard called The Action. So you can see Frank is, like, wearing a tie, you know, and his hair doesn't hit his shoulders. And most of the pictures in my book, you see these people before they grew any facial hair. Frank had a mustache, but very, very little facial hair in those days, just before before the 1967 happened.
Well, we've had Lisa Law on the show, and she's, you know, a big activist, as I'm sure you know. And it you know, her seeing it through a camera lens, you being able to see it through your eye, and then to be able to write it, and to say you have no confidence in your writing. Now, my shoe's coming off now, Dominic. I'm going to have to hit you a little bit because the book is fabulous, okay? You know, I mean, in particular, you're considered an expert on one of the Beach Boys albums. Why did you hone in on that?
Well, you know, I was told I was crazy for writing a whole book about an album that never came out, which was called Smile. But what ended up happening is 37 years after he nearly finished Smile in 1967, Brian Wilson finally did finish it. And it did come out as a solo Brian Wilson album, and that, you know, it was sort of like a snowball. I did this book, and then a lot of people read the book. I've sold, I think, 65,000 copies of that particular book. And so many people got that book, and it just created this mushroom of interest in the Beach Boys' Smile album, which would have had Good Vibrations on it, which would have had Surf's Up on it, some of their very most epic works. Mm-hmm. And it eventually came out on a box set, and thank goodness I got to do the booklet inside the box set, too, for the Beach Boys and Capitol Records, so that was nice.
Oh, that cool. Is great. I mean, you know, Brian, there's nothing to say. What a genius. I mean, and Van Dyke Parks and the whole lot.
Yeah, so, yeah, Van Dyke. I think we have mutual friends there, May, in Van Dyke Parks.
Yes, Van Dyke. Henry Diltz is another friend. I mean, you know, you and I, when we start to go down the list, we'll have a real group. I wish we could all get together and with some, you know, and have a reunion. It would be fun.
Yeah, I like to do events in Los Angeles, and also I've done them in New York too. I did these little film festivals at the Egyptian Theater that basically showed how a lot of the exploitation of this mid-60s, Sunset Strip era became the whole new Hollywood movement. Movies like The Trip were predecessors to Easy Rider and the other things. This is when all those guys, those filmmakers were working for American International Pictures, and their whole game at American International was to exploit the teenagers, and so you had people like Jack Nicholson writing movies for them. And it was just an interesting time, not just in Los Angeles, for the Byrds to have emerged in 1965, and then caroming off of that, you get the Doors, Frank Zappa's Mothers, the Buffalo Springfield, the Mamas and the Papas, and a lot of soul and Chicano groups too that broke out of East L.A.
Oh,
so,
I couldn't believe the pictures of Pat and Lolly Vega. I mean, you know, they were Redbone was one of my favorite bands back then.
You know, those groups were all like house bands. And were so, the thing is, there were so many clubs. Like, we all know that the Whiskey A Go-Go opened in 1964 with Johnny Rivers, and he made a live album there. And that kind of gave the Strip its first real hint of rock and roll fame. But then a year later, the Byrds played at Ciro's, and they were like a house band. I mean, they opened up for Little Richard when Jimi Hendrix was in Little Richard's band. So this was an exciting time. Jimmy remembers, in one of the interviews, the first time he met the Byrds was at Ciro's. And then the funny thing, like during that whole time, Jimmy goes and makes a record with Arthur Lee in 1965, before Love, before, you know, the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and they were backing a girl singer. So it was interesting. It's just an interesting moment that all these people converge, you know, at one place at one time. That's what makes the book fascinating.
Yes,
and there was such a proliferation of talent, and yet they all... And we've talked to some of these artists who were there, okay, and they all had such a humbleness about the appreciation of each other's work. That's what's amazing to me. See, everybody, you know, the generation before that generation were like, oh, counterculture, you know, everybody was suspect of hippies and all of that. But in truth, there was a lot more innocence than there was nonsense. In my view, and I'm not a music person, but now
it's all about the music.
Now,
it was all about the feel. It was all about it was the love, peace, and happiness era of, and everybody enjoyed themselves, and you know, everybody couldn't wait to get the guitar in hand or drums and just work with each. Everybody just wanted to be with everybody, and out of it came all this great music. And, you know, when you look at these photos, you go, oh, when they went on from one band to the next, whatever it may, however it went on to, it was great. You know, we won't have that type of scenario.
Camaraderie,
And camaraderie. Then that, so that it's great that we could, you know, you especially can write about it. And, you know.
Thank you. You know, I spoke to John Sebastian, who was probably the most prominent pop musician in New York in 1965 and 1966 with the Love and Spoonful breaking out of there, and then of course the Young Rascals broke out in New York, and then the Velvet Underground were sort of the underground group in New York at the time in the middle 60s. But John Sebastian and kind of we had a discussion about this very thing, and the difference between what was going on in New York during the 1960s and other places and then what happened in Los Angeles in 65-66 was this great sense of cross-pollination, which is a phrase that I learned first hearing David Crosby speak it. But, you know, Sebastian had a really good, interesting New York perspective on how in California people seem to give and share and take of each other's music a lot more than say, like in New York, where you were sitting in one corner and somebody else was in another corner and there was a little bit of competitive vibe on the scene and who's going to draw more people. And in L.A., people were just kind of handing each other their music, and it's one of the reasons why I chose Arthur Lee to do the foreword from the band Love. He was still with us when I was finishing the book, and the band Love if you trace the first three albums by the original lineup of the group, they move through so many styles. At one point, you think you're hearing Johnny Mathis, and another point you're hearing Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass, but it's all within this intense psychedelic music, you know. And Forever Changes may be the landmark album of that whole time, although there were albums by the first album by the Doors and so on and so forth. I just thought that Arthur Lee was one guy who touched, you know, he came out of the South Central L.A. scene. He made demos for Sam Cooke's SAR label and didn't really kind of go well there, so he moved his band over to East Los Angeles and played with the Chicano community, and then out of that, the Beatles come out, boom, he's on the Sunset Strip playing, you know, kind of like Rolling Stones or garage-ish kind of covers, and then mingling with the folk rock because the Birds are the hot group on the Strip at the time, and then, you know, everything else starts, he meets Hendrix, and they play together, and before you know it, you know, how all this music touched each other really came out in the sounds, and that's why I think the unique sounds that happened in the Los Angeles scene of 1965-66 deserves some sort of a focused document, you know?
Right. No, you're right.
Well, I mean, that whole Sunset, the whole mystery, the whole fairy tale, the whole folklore of the Sunset Strip, I mean, you're right, it permeated into movies, and then later on into TV shows, and that whole culture of the Surf Boys and the Bikini Girls, it was different than an East Coast vibe. The whole vibe is different. You know, it's
still absolutely.
Today,
I mean,
don't you think, Dominic?
I know the bands we're talking about. I mean, I still do. I'm, you know, the Rascals are friends of mine, and I see them on a regular basis around here. And it's true. There was a competitive New York had generated more of a competitive side as the West Coast has that feel of, yeah, camaraderie much more than we do here on the East Coast. I guess the surfer side, you know, I guess the beach and and being laid back is what generated a lot of that, much more.
Well,
than
can I tell you something to that effect? And that is, you know, by the time I got to high school, it was the same way. There wasn't as much of a difference between jocks and musicians as you had in other cities, because a lot of our best, football players or baseball players on our teams were also surfers. And so because they were surfers, they had that counterculture vibe before there was a counterculture. Their whole thing was to get out into nature and get away from people and get to the beach and get to an uncrowded spot. And you know what I mean? They really had a direct communion with nature in that respect.
Right.
So a lot of these kids who became in garage bands in L.A. in the middle 60s, you know, there wasn't this sort of competitive, they didn't have as much competitive vibe, because surfing really isn't a sport, you know. If you really are a surfer, it's not a sport, it's something beyond that, you know, it's something closer to Zen.
Right, it is. It's the really one with nature, you know, going through, when I see these photos of guys going through that funnel, when, you know, when the wave is just coming over them, and you just see that they're just having, I wish, it's exhilarating to see, and, you know, even in the photo.
And I think there's an innocence in that too, though, don't you think, May? Because I don't think any of it, Dominic, was intentional. I don't think they said, "Oh, we will be surf boys and we will be known."
I think
the way that they were, you know.
Yeah, it was just a feeling, and I think, you know, with that, when you see those photos, it just puts me at ease. As at the same time, it's when I say exhilarating, it's just amazing to see what Mother Nature, what they are doing, you know. When they're on their surfboard, I don't swim, so there's a whole thing. Watch this, you know. So it's a whole other thing. Yeah, I love to watch it.
It's interesting because Rick Griffin, who was a cartoonist for Surfer Magazine in the first half of the 60s and was living in L.A., whatever, and doing things from like about 1960 to 1966, then moves to San Francisco and becomes the most well-known psychedelic poster artist, and he did beautiful work, you know. So this is kind of the reflection. That kind of vibe was already in the surfing thing, and it turned into something even more interesting once psychedelic music came on, and all the other things like folk rock. And one of the things that made L.A. interesting then, too, is that the Rolling Stones broke in Los Angeles about maybe 8 months before anywhere else. They had this big hit in San Bernardino, and the Rolling Stones actually flew to San Bernardino just to get that gig going. They did a New York gig, and they did a Hollywood Palace TV show, and they went back, you know. It was a very quick thing, but what they left behind was a bunch of kids who were already into the Stones. Like, by summer of 1964, everybody was already playing Stones music, which was way ahead of the rest of America, you know. And that's what kind of gave us a little bit of a head start here.
And you know,
well,
and
plus too, it was different then. It had to be radio play. It had to be word of mouth. It's not like now where, you know, where everything's a soundbite. Whoop, it's gone. Something's replaced it. You know, it was
just right. It's all
come
in 2 seconds, and it's downloaded, and it's here.
Back
then, that's why we had promotion men. That's why it was, you know, they walked the beat, and they had to do what they had to do to get the airplay, and you know, and it's and it, I, in this generation, I don't think they understand how hard it was back then to get your record played.
Stones came here about 6 times. I mean, they in the course of 3 years, they were in L.A. like twice a year to play shows. I mean, back and forth, you know. And they also were recording a lot of their albums. And Satisfaction was recorded right here on Sunset Boulevard, RCA Music Center of the World. Paint It Black was recorded there. Last Time was recorded there. So the best studios in the world were here at the time. RCA Music Center of the World was the best studio, and the Stones flew 8,000 miles just to use it. So we had them right in our environment. They weren't just locked into London the whole time. They were actually doing a lot of experiments, working with people like Jack Nitzsche and Phil Spector here in L.A. So this is also moving music ahead from Los Angeles.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, it bears the question now, Dominic. Are you a musician?
I used to be.
What did you play?
I kind of quit playing music in the 70s, and my friend once told me, hey, it knocked out a lot of better people than you, so, you know. But, yeah, the 70s were not – I mean, when I tried to get a band going, I wanted to play Gene Genie by David Bowie, and I wanted to play I Can't Explain by The Who.
The Who.
And, you know, some of these kids in bands, they would just refuse to play David Bowie because he was gay. I mean, that's the kind of shit I was dealing with. I'm sorry for cursing on your radio show, but
that's the kind of reason
I kind of quit. I quit and trying to play with these kids in my neighborhood anyway, because that was so backward, you know. And turns out when I read Brendan Mullen's book, We Got the Neutron Bomb, about the punk scene in L.A., every kid was into Bowie or The Who. That was their big thing. The kids who became punk rockers in L.A. were all Bowie and Who kids, and that would have been me. So that's when I quit playing music.
So what instrument? Was it a guitar?
Yeah, what'd you play?
I used to play bass, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It never ceases to amaze me that the people that really feel the heart and soul of the fact that they have to keep pushing it forward and saying for appreciation, you know, usually wanted to do it themselves but just realized they had a better way of supporting it. And that's what you've done. I mean, this book is really, really a pretty book. And it's when I say pretty, I don't mean, you know, it's a beautiful book, and it's a great Christmas gift.
It would be nice,
book.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
One thing, I was going to mention Rubber Soul by the Beatles came out in December of 1965. And the interesting thing about that is we know that such a major album change for the Beatles, them moving into sort of maybe a more progressive sound. And what had happened, and I was talking to Gene Clark early in my stages of making this book, the lead singer of the Byrds, who told me, yeah, well, the time that we hung out with the Beatles was the time that they were coming up with those Rubber Soul songs. And if you look at Rubber Soul, it has a fisheye lens cover with suede jackets in a forest, much like what the cover of the Byrds' Mr. Tambourine Man album was. So it's amazing how much the Byrds had an influence on what became Rubber Soul. And in turn, Rubber Soul had such an influence on Pet Sounds. So this is what, you know, the larger picture shows, is the cross-pollination of great music just translated back and forth from England to Los Angeles during that period in a very profound way. And so that's why the book is an important one to pick up for its place in music history.
And it is a historical book, and it is a tribute to the fact that time existed, and there was great respect and sharing and appreciation, and it's kind of gone by the wayside. Now, if somebody wants to get this book, Dominic, where do they go?
Right.
Well, you could, best thing to always do is go to your local bookstore, the closest bookstore to your house, and order it. You know, I always like to say support the local bookstores, you know. But if you're in a remote area and or in a place where you couldn't get it in a bookstore, then Amazon.com has them up, and there's a nice little bio of me there, and some of my other books are there, too.
There
well,
you go.
It was great to have you on. I have the book. I was going to give it to my son, but I'm keeping it. And
now he can go out and get it himself. Yeah,
exactly. And just once again, Dominic, and I really mean this from a heartfelt standpoint, it is important for people like you who want to do this, who want to document these things, because we're fast fading away from these days, and they need to be on paper so people can say, okay, that time really did happen. You know, it was great. The book is fantastic.
I tried to make a catalog of music that people could, you know, maybe go up and if they're up on their computers, they can click on if they need to, and they can find all of these obscure records I talk about. And there's a lot of, you know, famous records that everybody knows, but there's also a lot of obscure things that you might discover. And I think that's probably the hidden gift in the book, is that you will discover so much music from going through its pages and just going back on the computer and trying to find those songs. You know, there's so many great ones.
Exactly.
Right.
Well,
exactly.
I'm sure this is just, I'm sure more is to come from you, Dominic. And so, see, we always make people promise to come back. So we're going to make you promise.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Too.
I will do. It's been fun talking. We've got to make that list of mutual friends a little more close.
Yeah. Yeah, May, you guys have to swap war stories.
Absolutely.
That would be cool.
Dominic, when you come to New York, you know, I hope we get together. And, you know.
Yes, that'd be great.
Yes. We will catch you. We'll get each other's
Dominic.
Info.
Yeehaw. I'm down in Nashville.
All right.
So you can pop in and, yeah, you can hang with me. I'll hang with you, Dominic.
I've been there before, too. Go. Yeah, it's a great place.
See?
Love it all.
All right. So we're
going to
let you go.
And thank you.
Thanks for coming on. We loved having you.
Yes.
Thank you, too. Appreciate
okay.
your help.
Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Have a great holiday. Bye.
And that is Riot on Sunset Strip, Rock and Roll's Last Stand in Hollywood. The book is really fantastic, even if you're not a music-y person.
Absolutely.
Like me.
What a great history. Yeah. It's just history.
Oh, yeah.
People don't realize music is, there's history to all of this. This is not just...
Well, they don't realize how everybody was connected either. That's the thing that fascinates me. You know, it's not like that now. It's not. I mean,
oh, no,
I live
it's
Nashville,
so disjointed
and,
somewhere.
Yeah, oh, please.
It's disjointed.
You go down
it
a
is.
Music row, the left hand does not want the right hand knowing what they're doing. It just, there is no camaraderie. None.
No.
None. And I'm
it's
saying
true.
It. So.
And, no, I've been there. I mean, a lot of people don't realize I've been in this business since 1969, and I was a little girl.
She was 3 years old. She was a prodigy.
I was 3 years old, and you know, and I've been very lucky. I met a lot of people. And I got to know them. I've been friends with them, and I'm just very blessed. I am just very blessed. On a note before we, you know, we depart from all of this. I just want to say, I'm going to, Cha-Cha, I wanted to say a memory for Cha-Cha, who was part of
the
Sopranos.
Yeah.
And
the mayor
tonight
of Little
is
Italy.
Wake. That's right.
Yeah.
So there you go. And I'm going to see him later.
That'll be
yeah.
interesting. That'll be an interesting
the,
cast
at the wake,
of characters.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Wow. And he
I'll
would
let you
love
know
it,
about
too.
That. Yes.
So. Hi, so what's coming up for you? Anything?
Nothing
or?
Except the holidays are coming up, and I just got to deal
don't
with that.
Don't even start
you know.
Me. I've done nothing. You know, and now I'm entering the 3 weeks of chaos with my catering job. So, you know how that goes. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
So that's it. So
okay.
there you go.
All right.
That's my.
So,
that's, and I hope to see you one day soon.
I know. We keep saying that. All right. I'm going to Skype you after the show. I'm going to Skype
know.
You, girl.
I will see you then.
All right,
have
Mary.
A good one. Okay.
That's May Pang, and I'm Cynthia Nielsen. Thanks to our guest, Dominic Priori, and his book, Riot on Sunset Strip, Rock and Roll's Last Stand in Hollywood. You've been listening to Dinner Specials on Blog Talk Radio.